Say again. Yes, for the dollar. And the father and the dollar. Yes. There is a reward involved. So we can actually meet the goddess on the way to meeting. Not the slightest. She had real poise and aplomb. And she stayed and talked to me without fear, and she laughed a little bit. Yeah.
I think it was important that she showed you the egg. If she had just said, I'm delivering eggs, and didn't, but the fact that she lifted up and held it up is, you know, is something.
Yes. And can you relate that to the pictures of the vulva? On the stone walls of caves in France? I can do that without any problem. Okay. Whatever more that I had in my notes, I think I can deal with tomorrow. Let's put that away. Oh, so many words. Okay. Enough of that. Now I want to reflect together about what I've tried to bring you today. I think you can see that, as I said yesterday, I came not to offer you peace and rest. I came to offer you fire and a sword, if you want to think about that. This is a work to be done. And it's something that everybody can do and really is obliged to try, I think. So what kind of things have come up in your mind as we have talked, as I have talked today and you've listened? Now, let's get a mic.
I have it here.
Okay. It doesn't.
Well, is this, I don't know if this is on. Well, the Logian, too, that you were referring to.
Oh, I'm sorry. We'll start again.
The Logian, too, that you were referring to has most often been shortened to seek and you shall find. And that means get the right answer and then stop, which would lead us to the state of Nicodemus, which is the collective standpoint, and I've got the answer and you don't. And so that's what I think is so wonderful about Logian 2, which is do not stop seeking until you find, and when you find, you will be disturbed. Because it's inviting you to a new paradigm. It's inviting you to come to something that you have not ever imagined before.
So the implication is that there's no path to this new state that doesn't go through disturbance.
Without blowing you away, yes. Yeah. It's something beyond your wildest imaginings, and then it opens up all new worlds.
Yes,
so
exactly.
So that's the threatening thing. It's not that you can just sit back and relax in all your certainties.
In other words, this death of initiation is a real death. It's a real ending. I can remember when I was a boy of 11, I was baptized in the Baptist church. And the Baptists always practiced full immersion. They were proud of it. No sprinkling for them. And so in the front of the church, there was this big, big spa-like bathtub. And the water was in there, comfortably warm, and about to the waist. And I wade in with my white trousers, and the pastor is standing there. And the congregation is seated up in front watching this ritual initiation. Drama. And I walk up to him, and he has a little white handkerchief. He puts it over my face, puts his hand behind my shoulders, and down I go in the water for about, I don't know, maybe it felt like 10 minutes, but it might have been 3 to 5 seconds. And then back up again, streaming water down. And I remember that in the congregation, I heard a sound something like this. But with that act, I had died as a boy of 11, and I was now a young man, still of 11, a member of the church. It was a death and a rebirth right there in that little town. January the 11th, 1941. That's a date forever emblazoned in my memory. So those symbolic deaths are in a certain way real, and they have to be lived as real, it seems to me, to have psychological effect. They cannot be the result of an idea. Oh, I see it's necessary to have this thought that I'm dying and it's going to be interesting and afterwards I'll be a new person. No, that doesn't work. We know that very clearly. Anything else? Yes, Walter. Thank you. That was a good take on Logan, too.
Two things. The first one is from last night. We were talking about darkness in or shadow in archetypes, and Jung thought that God had a dark side, an evil side. You can see that particularly in his answer to Job. Now, John Youngblood disagreed with Jung. He didn't think that God had an evil side. I was wondering, as another distinguished Quaker Jungian, besides you and I, how do you feel on that question?
I think there are three of us now, right?
Yes.
I do have a definite feeling about that. My own sense is that if God does not incorporate negativity of the most extreme kind, then it is an incomplete God and cannot be tolerated. It requires us to do something which twists the mind into little curlicues, which is to hold together at the same time the notion of God as benevolent, loving, all of that, and consummate darkness. Consummate good, consummate darkness. In the 139th Psalm, I think it is, that's the famous psalm that says, even though I take the wings of the morning and fly to the uttermost parts of the world, you find me there. He's talking about how God seeks him out, the psalmist is. He's saying, if I go somewhere at a great distance, you'll find me. You know where I am. And if I pull my cloak over my head so as to disappear in the dark, you find me even there. And here's the key, Psalm 139. For the light is as the dark to thee. So there's my text.
I'm sorry I'm not impressed with your proof text, but I'm with Youngblood that the mystery of God is how there can be an all-powerful God in a world where there is so much evil. And as mystics, we just have to live with that mystery. That's my take on it anyway. My second comment was just that saying that you quoted from Thomas is often attacked as being a Gnostic saying, and that,
yes.
Orthodox Christianity sees that as a heresy.
Yes, it's true. Well, in fact, the whole of Thomas is largely a Gnostic document. Now, there's a pattern of thought that says that makes it reprehensible. Certainly that was the view of the early church. But remember, the early church had certainly political considerations as well. They were trying to get a consistent consensus as to what the Christian story was. And so there was some difficulty in incorporating not only Gnosticism, but Arianism, and so forth. So there were there were several kinds of Christianity extant in the first century, as you know. And there were many more books available trying to give a voice to that movement than there are now. So I tend to think that there was a lot of conflict, and the prevailing party was able to label as heretical another point of view. I find that heresy, I call it the watering can of the garden of the soul. I find heresy an essential thing. Somebody has to say, wait a minute, I don't think that's right. And you see, you and I are holding together two different versions of the relationship of the ultimate entity and evil. That's okay. That's even good, because it creates turbulence around that whole idea and causes us to relate to it. I don't mind. I like that, in fact. There is another question in the back up there, behind you, Walter.
And Joe has a microphone on that side, so we can go from side to side. Who's over here?
My name's Ian, and I was thinking about how similar the passage, it's strange that it's condemned as a Gnostic variation, but it sounds very similar to me to something that's in the Orthodox Gospels about where Jesus talks about old wine or new wine going into old wineskins, and how the old wineskins will burst and break, which seems like the disturbance that you reach. But if you have a new wineskin, then it can hold the new wine.
Yes.
And this also seems very similar to me to Piaget's ideas as well, Jean Piaget, the idea that when we take in any kind of new information that goes against our construction of the world, we first interpret that information on the basis of our construction, usually distorting the new information, or distorting, you know, what we've received, making errors in the process, or what are perceived as errors. But after a while, the process of taking in the new information as it is leads us to completely change our whole way of constructing the world?
Yes, I think that's a pretty good description of a process that involves living into that new place. The demands, let's say, of a new attitude toward the world and toward life do prove troublesome at first, because they require so much adjustment of behavior and thought. And it's hard. And that's why I think that the imagery that's grown up around initiatory experience is that of dying and being born again. And it's everywhere in the world and at all times. I think it may be tomorrow that I want to talk a little bit about about initiation, as Mircea Eliade writes about it. He's a guy who wrote about the mystery of initiation and its rituals. And he points out there is no successful initiation without a death of the kind we've been talking about, and a reconstitution afterwards in a new form. The thing that helps that to happen is ritual. So, for example, in some, I wouldn't presume to call them primitive societies. I would call them traditional societies. For example, when a boy, up till the time that a boy is 12 years old, excuse me, he lives in his mother's house. When he's 12, the men of the village come and get him and take him out to the bush. And there he undergoes circumcision, no anesthetic, of course. And after that's performed on the 12-year-old, he and his other buddies are taken by the men to a shallow grave that's been dug in the earth. And they're made to lie down in that place overnight, and they're covered with dry brush. That's their burial. Meanwhile, the men are away singing and dancing, and the boys can hear it. It's a bit fearsome. They hurt, and all this strange new stuff is going on around them as they lie there under that dry brush. The next morning, the men come back, and with great sounds of joy and fervor, they throw the brush off, lift the boys up, and take them off to start their training as young men in the community. There's a similar ceremony for a girl as she approaches first menses. The women do that. The women have done that in recent times among Native American communities. I know in the Navajo community, it's a practice to take the girls out, or it was until recent times, for a period of time until they're restored to the village. They come in triumphantly as new young women in the community. So those transitions are hard. And if they aren't hard, they're probably not genuine. And it's as if we can't really escape the initiations, this dying and being reborn multiple times. Well, then think what it's like for an adult or for a person who has had to give up and renounce, in fact, a way of viewing the world to take on something else.
Can I ask
Jung
a follow-up?
Is a case in point. You know, he didn't have an exactly easy life among the intelligentsia of Europe at the time he was announcing his thinking. So I don't know where I want to go with that, but I think it you could say that in a certain sense Jung passed through his own ritual of initiation into new ways of thinking. After coming out of university in Basel as a fresh new MD. And it was only the greatest of good luck, in a sense, that drove him up to the Burkholzli Hospital in Zurich, which was at that time, and still to a certain extent, exclusively accepts psychotic patients. Over in Vienna, Freud was meeting with high-functioning, upper-middle-class Jewish ladies and developing another brilliant new line of thought. One has to give proper credit to Sigmund Freud, a very great scientist and thinker. But Jung was caught in his own maelstrom over in Zurich. Even today, it's very difficult to find a good word said about Jung. Both in writing and in orally. It's still a little bit. What's the right word? Déclassé. To be a Jungian. So continue.
Sorry, just a follow up. Then is Jesus talking about a general process that's, you know, starting in childhood and continues on, and it's something that's going through all stages of our lives, or is he talking about a moment, you know, a particularly key moment, which is a one-time, you know, pushing against the boundaries, coming to this crisis or this disturbance, and then that falling away and there being this connection to the all? Is it a one-time, or is it a multiple recurring process? Or is there no need for dichotomy?
I'm not aware that the text actually makes that clear. But personally, I can't imagine that he would be talking about a one-time affair. The process of spiritual development seems to me to be continuous, and I can't imagine that we would ever reach an endpoint. What would that endpoint be like? There is no more spiritual discovery. As long as we're in the human frame, I don't see that there is an endpoint there, because we would have to become transmuted into godlike creatures ourselves. So I see it, and I want to be consistent on that. I see it as a continuing process all the way through. As Ibn Arabi says, if you do not stop there, there is another revelation. And when you take that in and absorb that, if you don't stop with that, you remember he said, Allah is testing you. He wants to see if you'll be satisfied with the last reincarnation. And if you are, he's gone. Down here.